And this is now talking with Al Peterson on 22nd September 1981 at NASA Ames. Let me ask, first of all, what was your educational background, and then how did you first come into contact with meteor radar astronomy?
Well, let's see, I think I was, I know I was still a student and even an undergraduate student at Stanford at that time, I guess, when I first started working with them.
In what department?
In electrical engineering department, and my earliest work, I guess, was building equipment and helping to take measurements in the area of the meteor radar. And the earliest time, we were mostly interested in learning about meteors,
right,
their orbits, and
now, who was the leader of the group?
Oh, Villard was the leader of that group at that time. And he had gotten started sometime earlier than that. I don't know if you've talked to him.
No, I haven't. Where is he?
He's at Stanford.
He's still at Stanford,
huh? He's most of his time at SRI at this point.
Mm-hmm.
That work was so, amongst the earliest, I guess, that was done, really. It was our group and people, McKinley and Millman up in Ottawa.
Right, and the Jodrell Bank.
And Jodrell Bank. I'm not sure that whether Jodrell Bank was...
Yeah, they were going from about 46 on.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that's about right. I know they did quite a lot later. And,
so you,
being part of an engineering activity, we did about half of our effort in that area ended up having to do with communications and related subjects and not just meteor.
Was this also influenced by the fact that it was... I was just going to ask... was part of the application to communications a result of the funding, which was from the military, I believe, also?
I don't think it was specifically that. We were at least Villard and I, had always had communication interests and were working in communications before, well, he was working long before he did the meteor work, and I had worked on various aspects of communications hardware before. So I don't think it was that strongly influenced by funding.
Well, so you got an undergraduate degree in what year then?
Probably 48.
And then you continued on in that same department. And was your thesis work involved with this kind of thing? Or
no, it was involved with the use of ionospherically collected backscatter sounding of studies of the ionosphere.
But then I see that around 52, you're writing with Manning and Villard on a double Doppler.
Oh yeah, I kept working on these things, but the thesis subject in 52 was in a... still involved studies of upper atmosphere physics and the like, but it was a completely different area.
I see. So is it fair to say then that this meteor radar work at Stanford really came out of a communications-oriented thing far more than astronomical?
Yeah, I think so. Manning is the possible exception.
Yeah. You said that Villard was more or less the leader of the group.
Right.
Could you characterize for me what the roles of the different people were as to where their expertise was being applied?
Well,
in the late 40s?
In the late 40s on meteors, Manning was primarily interested in the theoretical aspects, and Villard and I in experiments.
And building equipment and
making carefully planned experiments of one kind or another. Somewhere in the, I guess it was a little later, I built an automatic or instantaneous direction finder to help us work on following, in effect, following the radiance of the meteors and as a function of time of day, as things changed and so forth.
And so, is that what led to this 1956 paper in JGR?
Probably did.
Properties of oblique radio reflections.
The oblique radio reflections were really made at with separated transmitters and receivers, and did involve a lot of sorting out of the combination of Earth's geometry and rotation relative to the orbits of the various meteor trails. But, let's see. Yeah, I think that was more done at with separated transmitters and receivers, and there was some DFing involved in that too. But in that case, the geometry of the transmission paths helped sort out what was actually going on.
Just from my background, which is not very great in communications, to say the least, did the meteor scatter means of communications prove useful in that
era?
Well,
it did. The Canadians had an active communication system they used for some time, and NATO had a path that went from Norway clear down into Italy that they used the meteor scanner on. In recent years, there's been a use of it in telemetry of data. Well, one place I know about was up in the Northwest where they were using it for remote weather stations.
Yes, I came across that also.
And, it was kind of an amusing thing. When we first did it, the difficulty in making it really practical was that we didn't have ready access to random access memory and had to buffer the data that were going in with stop tape recorders. And so it was somewhat messier than it needed to be, but it certainly is a practical means. And it's come up again in the last several years. There's talk of using it in various defense communications.
I see. So when was it begun to be used? In the mid-50s sometime?
Towards the late 50s.
Late 50s.
Project Janet up in Canada was one. We did some experiments between Stanford and Montana State University up in Bozeman. And
so is it fair to say then that meteor radar astronomy led to a very practical
I think so. Result. It never has been used in any wholesale fashion like satellite communications or ionospheric communications, but it's been a recurring theme, and people find specialized uses for it.
Well, looking at the publications that were in my bibliography, which are only a small fraction of all of yours, to do with the upper atmosphere and so forth, you were worried somewhat about auroral noise at one stage and about what the Project Argus H-bomb did.
We certainly were involved with those.
A bit outside of my...
It's really outside of radio...
My realm. But then you pop up in 1960 with a review article in
well, by that time...
No, I'm sorry. You did also before then. These are not in order. You had the articles in SRI reports and IRE transactions about your radars at Stanford, Alaska. Can you tell me who was the person that really first came up with the idea of doing some lunar and or solar radar and how that developed at Stanford?
Well, I guess the lunar work probably came up in connection with my joint work between Stanford and SRI, where at SRI we built radars for studying various upper atmosphere problems, flutter in connection with missile detection radars, mm-hmm. things of that kind. Then Eshelman and Tay Howard, I guess, got involved in the solar work, and my activity there was rather peripheral, although in some ways fairly essential, because I was involved with a sort of the earliest of the computer activities at Stanford in that 1950s
time
frame. Yeah, we managed to obtain a gift machine from IBM that we installed for just these kinds of purposes mm-hmm. in the mid-50s.
Which
something called an IBM 797, which mm-hmm. is of which there were only three, I think, built in the country. It was a machine with sort of the earliest of core memory and some 7,000 vacuum tubes
mm-hmm.
that was able to be completely reconfigured by plugboard wiring.
Right.
It's kind of like microprogramming at the earliest
stages. At the macro level.
And yeah. We put that thing to doing the analysis of the solar echoes and also in some cases of lunar data.
Mm-hmm.
And you notice there's a reference to Egan in some paper there on the Royal Noise. But he had worked with me on this, getting this machine going, and had actually done the reconfiguration that made it practical to do the analysis that led to doing the solar echoes.
But now, what was the motivation to do the lunar came first, I presume? Or?
Oh, the motivation in the lunar case, I guess partly was because it was fun and we thought we could learn something about the surface structure by radar, and we were also interested in the possible use of lunar reflections for communications, and you know that kind of system did go in and was used for some years by the Navy between Washington D.C. and Hawaii.
About when did that go in?
Oh, I don't know. I'd have to look back, but it must have been around 1960. Or
that was during the whole Sugar Grove business, also when
the
military was quite interested.
Yeah. Now I, at the time, all during the 50s, and was involved in a communications and radio propagation laboratory at SRI, as well as teaching at Stanford and working with research students, so that we were able to build at least some of the facilities, the big antenna that's up there now.
The 120 foot, is it?
Or it's 150 feet.
150 foot.
Because we were working on a variety of problems that the Defense Department was willing to support. There were another two, one built for NRL and another one for Air Force Cambridge Research Land.
Oh, that's the same as
that's the same as the one up here. The one down on Chesapeake.
Right. What's the site in West Virginia also? Is that Sugar Grove also?
No.
No, it's not. I can't think of it, but I know.
Anyway, there was one that was used.
It's the same design, I see.
There was one that was used up in Boston and Cambridge. It's been, I think Lincoln Lab now has it and uses it for electron scatter, John Evans and his people. But we built three at that time.
When you started on the lunar radar, were you influenced at all by what had been done? For instance, the Jodrell Bank about that time was doing some lunar radar.
Oh, I'm sure we were influenced. We read all that stuff and were reasonably close to the people at Jodrell Bank, both in the meteor work and on the radar work. None of us were, in those days, none of us were really in radio astronomy. We'd all been in radar and communications work. And of course, later on, Bracewell came around and brought in an influence in radio astronomy per se.
But well, that's what I'm getting
at. All of our work tended to, in one way or another, branch out from other things we were doing at in the same time frame.
That's what I was getting at. Is it a fair representation to more or less see the work done at Stanford before Bracewell arrived as really not being a part of the radio astronomy community?
That's right. We of course had much involvement with ERSI and with the and with AGU in the radio wave propagation business rather than in radio astronomy.
Right.
And then later formed this interest in first lunar, then solar, and eventually planetary studies using radio techniques. And Eshelman, later Tyler over there, have kind of been exclusively in that side of it with NASA ever since NASA got started. We formed this something called the Center for Radar Astronomy, which involved people at SRI and at Stanford.
When was that formed?
Oh, I think it was 62.
Mm-hmm.
And we built some receiving equipment to go in early spacecraft. In fact, I think there's a picture of some of that in here.
In this 63 pamphlet?
Yeah. Oh, that's the VLF one, but that Halliwell was involved with. But maybe it isn't in here. I thought there was, but in any event, we built some receiving equipment that went in one of the early Mariners and transmitted from a big facility, because at the time the concept hadn't been worked out for using the actual data links from the spacecraft for these science things. At that time, they wouldn't let you do any fiddling. It was all housekeeping data. And
I see. So you had your own separate
transmitter. We had our own separate transmitters on 50 and 400 megahertz that were the early sources of signal to the satellite, and then only the received data in the satellite were brought back, and that's the way one studied that.
And this is on which mission again?
Oh, I think it was Mariner 2 or 3, somewhere.
Right,
in
the, and this was to beam through the Venus atmosphere?
Right.
Right, I think Barrett had a microwave experiment also.
Yeah, I think so.
On that same
but
mission,
in any event, we were turning our knowledge of the Earth's ionosphere and its probing to doing this same sort of thing on the planets, and we're able to get
both
ionized ionosphere and atmospheric data.
Right. Well, tell me now about the lunar radar. You said that your main contribution was in the signal processing with this.
In the lunar radar case, we used facilities that had been put together for other radar studies at SRI.
Upper atmosphere studies, you mean?
Well, upper atmosphere studies, yeah. Satellite tracking and things of that kind. And studies of the aurora, because one of the activities that we had done at SRI was to begin to investigate the reflecting and scattering characteristics of the aurora in order to be able to predict difficulties for radars that were to go in Alaska and eventually over England. We did the experiments in Scotland and also along those lines, and that were aimed at finding suitable sites to avoid the most difficult part of the auroral scattering. So
was this for BMUs basically?
Yeah. Pre-BMUs
research.
I took, while I was an early graduate student, took some hardware up to Alaska in the early 50s and began to do some studies of the aurora. This was when Elvy was director up there.
But also in this 1958 paper, you did a 398 megahertz lunar radar from Alaska. Now I understand, I think, both the location and the frequency of it was directed towards what later became BMUs.
It did. The BMUs was actually higher frequency slightly, above 400, but this was one that we could we could use.
Yeah.
And so we took that equipment up. That was a 60-foot antenna that they've still got up there, I guess.
What was the main results, do you think, that came out of this lunar radar, from your point of view?
Well, I think probably work on surface roughness was about the only part concerning the moon.
Did you learn about communications abilities also? I mean, was that of any use to you?
Sure, certainly it was. We were able to determine sort of what sort of problems there were with modulating signals as a result of scattering and Doppler spreading.
Right.
And so yes, certainly there were those things. In the case of Aurora, I guess some combination of a group of people that I was in the center of, I guess, probably contributed much of the early work on Aurora. We learned a lot about radar Aurora.
Yeah, that's somewhat.
That's off your subject.
Further.
The only one that was kind of astronomical, I guess, was this business of looking for noise emitted, but I'm not quite sure that I would have classified it as astronomy either.
Radiometry of the atmosphere, yeah. Essentially.
Right.
Yeah. But now, what about the step to solar radar? Who's the push behind that?
I think probably Eshelman was the major push in that direction, although a lot of us encouraged it.
I have talked to him, and it's been several years that, yeah. I think I remember him giving me quite a bit of details about that.
Sure. One of his graduate students, Barthel, I think it was, did some of the early publication. But I guess it was kind of by that time, the group of us, primarily Eshelman and myself, with our own students that were, and Tay Howard, I guess, was joined in about that time.
And Dice?
Dice was a little bit later. He was at SRI first before he came to Stanford and had been working primarily on the Aurora. Dice always had the characteristics of never working on more than one thing at a time, so.
It's an admirable characteristic.
But it also doesn't necessarily lead to new people doing new things.
Yeah.
And he later got very interested in, obviously, in
planetary radar
and that sort of thing. But it always took significant stimulation. And since he's left Arecibo, he absolutely doesn't look at anything like that anymore. He's off doing a commercial venture, and you almost can't get him into a conversation on the subject.
he's left entirely. I haven't seen him since he left.
Yeah.
Was the idea of the solar radar primarily just a tour de force, or was there something?
There was that, but we also wanted to see what we could learn about the outer plasma region, which at the time was not really explorable by direct means. And
mainly from the occultation of the crab every year.
Right. There was that, but we certainly didn't have satellites out looking at streams
right.
and things.
Right.
So, and it was partly that it appeared with things that we had mostly in hand that we actually could do it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we thought that we'd probably find more things to do with it, but in fact, it looked like maybe there wasn't a really fertile field to follow up on there, so we didn't go more than we probably didn't play with that for more than 2 or 3 years or something.
Now, you mentioned planetary radar at Stanford. Now, I didn't.
No, we never did planetary radar directly, only through the spacecraft occultation.
That's what planetary radar refers to in the Center for Planetary Radar. I didn't think that Venus had ever been contacted.
No, we never did.
The 150 foot or anything.
We never did that, no.
Yeah.
And, but we first on the moon, Tyler did work with Eshelman and myself on lunar surface characteristics via essentially bistatic scattering off the moon from orbiters.
And this is now getting into the late 60s.
Yeah, right.
Okay, I then asked Peterson what he felt was the impact on radio astronomy on the fields of communications and study of the atmosphere and so forth that he had been involved in. And he felt that up until around 1960 or early 60s, that radio astronomy really was the leader in the push for bigger dishes and more sensitive receivers and phased arrays and this sort of thing. And then after that, the military and NASA have tended more to be in the lead, but that before then it was definitely the radio astronomers that were coming up with many of the neat ideas, so to speak, in the field. And he also felt that it's quite fair to characterize Stanford as always having been more interested in the study of communications and the atmosphere and so forth, and it's only almost by chance that they happened to come in contact with radio or radar astronomy here and there. So that ends the interview with Al Peterson on 22 September 1981, and this is the end of this side of the tape.